This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we have a conversation with Steve Coxett. He's the president of the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance. We'll take a look at the latest on passenger rail service here in Indiana and some other concerns that he and his colleagues with the Passenger Rail Alliance have about Amtrak and how it's doing. We'll also talk, too, in that conversation about passenger rail services like the Hoosier State. Also, a little bit later, a conversation with Griffith Town Council President Rick Rifa. He and his colleagues, along with the rest of the town government, getting ready for tomorrow's special election about secession from Calumet Township, if the voters in Griffith agree to it. That and more coming up, but first the news. Originally speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Chris Nolte. It's time to check in with Steve Coxett. He's the president of the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance to see what's the latest in passenger rail here in the region as well as in entire state of Indiana. As always, Steve, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Chris. Happy to be here.
We have talked in the past about, of course, localized service, and we do want to catch up on that to see what the latest is on the Hoosier State and on the Cardinal Lines. Those are, of course, Indiana's two major passenger rail services through Amtrak. But we also know, too, that you and other members of the Rail Alliance In the recent newsletter that came out, talked about some strategic goals that you and the Alliance would like to see done here in the Hoosier State. Will you take a few minutes and talk a little bit about how these all fit together, especially for us here in the region?
Okay, yeah, Chris. Of course, you know, the most immediate thing is improving the Hoosier State service. Currently, the state of Indiana supports one train a day in each direction. As we go into the next General Assembly budget session, the push is going to be to double that. So we have two trains a day in each direction, which, as you can imagine, makes travel planning for any purpose much easier. And it also pushes us up to the point where fare box can cover operating revenues. Beyond that, though, we started to look as an organization as to ideally what you would want the state of Indiana to have to be competitive transportation-wise in the 21st century. And there's a lot of things building off the existing service that could really be a plus. For instance, extending the Hoosier State on a daily basis to Cincinnati. That would link the Cincinnati, Indianapolis, and Northwest Indiana, and by implication, Chicago, with the Cincinnati metro area, which actually historically has been a very strong passenger market. Other things that could happen and have been talked about, let's say having a section, or actually resurrecting what used to be called the Kentucky Cardinal, which would link Louisville to Indianapolis, and time that to match the Hoosier State and the Cardinal arrivals and departures. And that would give us a link from Northwest Indiana down to Louisville, which would probably generate a great deal of traffic. Other things that have been talked about, for instance, are taking a section off of the Hoosier State or Cardinal at Indianapolis and running it over to St. Louis by way of, let's say, Springfield, Illinois. And that would give an alternative for transportation, between the center of our state and St. Louis, and also indirectly Northwest Indiana and St. Louis. So we're looking at those. We continue to support the Fort Wayne area's push for renewed service linking Chicago and Fort Wayne down to Columbus, Ohio, as well as looking at what we call light rail or commuter rail in areas other than Northwest Indiana. As you're aware, we're making progress expanding the South Shore up here to compete with the Chicago collar counties. There's also a growing demand for commuter services of some sort in central Indiana. The Indianapolis metropolitan area is expanding out into its own set of collar counties, and the highway network down there is becoming increasingly overloaded. There's interest in commuter rail from Indianapolis up through Anderson and Muncie, up through Noblesville and Tipton, and up through Frankfort into the West Lafayette area. So there's a lot that we could do. We don't have a master plan for accomplishing all this in the next General Assembly session. This is going to take quite some time and a lot of hard work. But in looking at what it will take to compete with other large metropolitan areas in the U.S. and also around the world, not only for business investment, but to attract the kind of workers, young, educated, mobile workers that people are going to need to work in 21st century businesses. So this is kind of the plan we've laid out, and we'll be expanding on that in future issues of the newsletter, and hopefully we'll be able to develop some traction as time goes by.
When you talk about all the ideas that you want to bring forth to the General Assembly, I'm sure many of them you'll probably bring forth at the start of before the next session coming up here. Mm-hmm. I know one of the things that you've talked about and you've insisted on that NDOT continue to support the Hoosier State financially and other areas too. But I understand too that everybody at the Alliance is very concerned about where some of the latest money that the state of Indiana is getting, that is to say the funds that are coming from the Indiana toll road and the increased tolls that are going to be levied onto trucks. But none of that is, I understand, going to passenger rail. Do you think there's any chances of making sure that some of that gets earmarked for passenger service?
Well, it's kind of a disappointment from our viewpoint because our understanding is that basically it's a done deal, that the allocations of the funding have already been made, and that in a political sense, this may have been what was necessary to get approval for Governor Whitcomb's deal. We are disappointed, though, if you look at a sum of $1 billion, and we have to remember, this is a one-time thing, so it wouldn't be considered a continued source of funding. But, for instance, you could do some interesting things. You know, you could put up a state match for the Fort Wayne Group's project. You could make some improvements on the Hoosier State right-of-way that would improve reliability and performance. You know, start some studies about Central Indiana commuter rail, especially looking at, it's hard to complain too much about the money for roads because, many of us know that the state of Indiana is having a hard time raising the money to keep its roads in repair. So that's a problem. But we look at, I think there was like $20 million that was allocated to promote international flights out of the Indianapolis airport. Well, well and good, but when we attempt to propose rail projects, politicians often tell us, well, we don't want to subsidize things. Well, this looks like a $20 million subsidy to the Indianapolis airport. You know, it may be all well and good, but I think it cuts the ground underneath out from people who say, well, we don't want subsidies, for instance. Basically the public, you know, and ourselves found out about this deal after it was done, where basically the state would give the owners or the leasees of the toll road the permission to raise the tolls, and in return they would make a one-time payment. Actually, I think it's in three or four parts in the state of Indiana. Looking at the fact that it was $1 billion, we're just disappointed that some of it, at least, couldn't have been allocated to promote rail in the state, especially because a few million would have gone a long ways towards starting some feasibility environmental studies, for instance. We always advocate a balanced approach, you know, which would include both modern rail and modern highway, as well as developing our aviation facilities.
We're talking with Steve Coxhead. He's president of the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance about what the alliance would like to see done as far as strategic planning for the future and working with the state legislature on these issues. I know that you and other members of the alliance have also had some concern here, and getting back to Amtrak, not so much, I guess, although you have concerns about the service, the Hoosier State, the Cardinal, and these other lines that I know that you mentioned that the strategic plan would like to bring back into service, like the route to Kentucky and Indiana. But you've mentioned that in the past that you all are concerned about, the overall business model for Amtrak. Tell us about that.
Yes. We have a new CEO and president at Amtrak, Anderson, whose previous job was over at Delta Airlines. And looking at the business plan he seems to be adopting for Amtrak, and mind you, we're criticizing not the individual but the plan itself. We just think he's got a wrong business plan, a plan that might have been, you know, appropriate and successful in the airline industries, but which we don't think works for passenger rail. And if you look at the approach he's been taking, it seems to involve cutting service, you know, in terms of cutting the number of places that are served by Amtrak system, eliminating a service component, you know, by which I mean to say is eliminating staffing at stations, eliminating onboard services, downgrading meal service and so forth. And there seems to be a sometimes not so subtle push to eliminate long distance trains outside of the East Coast. An example is the Southwest Chief, which links the Chicago, Northwest Indiana area to Los Angeles. And one proposal was, well, you know, Amtrak, you know, is going to have to pick up some of the heavy lifting for maintaining tracks in the middle of that route. So we're just going to cut the route into two segments, and we're going to have a bus shuttle between the two segment ends.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone that's been involved with passenger rail development, you know, would know that this would positively kill the service. And in fact, things like this were done in the 60s and 70s by railroads that wanted, you know, before the advent of Amtrak, when they wanted to justify killing service. They would remove a key segment, then they would go to the federal government and say, well, look, there's no passengers. We think Anderson and Amtrak has backed off from this in the case of the Southwest Chief. But it just seems to be the idea of cutting the service back to decrease costs, as opposed to providing the kind of world-class transportation service I think most people in this country would want if they were to stop and think about it. When you look at the airline industry now, you see a reduction in number of flights. You see a lot of communities have had a reduction in the number of flights serving their particular airport. We see a concentration on the hub and spoke concept, whereas the carrier really does nothing but shuttle passengers between major hubs. That may have some validity in the airline model, but in the railroad model, when you look at, for instance, like something like the Cardinal, it's you know, or the Hoosier State, it's not just serving two hubs, let's say Indianapolis and Chicago. It's serving places like Plainfield, Rensselaer, Dyer, Crawfordsville, Lafayette. So if you look at a hub and spoke concept, it's not really going to work for rail, because rail by its nature works best when it serves intermediate points. It's hard to make airliners serve intermediate points, so maybe that was appropriate for Delta. So what we seem to be seeing is that Anderson is taking a business model, which the airlines have used, and which may be appropriate in many cases for an air service, and applying it to what has always been intended to be a national passenger rail network. And we are just very much afraid that the man is charging full bore ahead with a business plan that's going to increase Amtrak's losses, make it even harder to finance, and make it harder for states like Indiana to work with. For instance, one of the great advantages to Indiana, we believe, in developing a 21st century rail system within the state is that it hooks into a national network, you know, so you can start out in various places in Indiana, get to and from numerous places, you know, within the country. So we're very much dependent upon the existence of that national network and its viability, even though our own organization, you know, is focusing primarily on Indiana. Yeah.
Now, Steve, let me ask, and you referred to this here in talking about the ideas that came up in the near-term strategic goals that the mm-hmm. Alliance wants to make. And you're talking about reviving the Kentucky Cardinal service out of Louisville into Indianapolis. And then you also mentioned, too, about extending lines from Indianapolis back out to out west to St. Louis, which, of course, I'm sure would mean that the line would end up going through Greencastle and other places like that, places that the Hoosier State makes along the way, or the Cardinal makes along the way. So I suppose that it wouldn't kind of put the kibosh on those, wouldn't it, if it's working with the same thought process and business model that seems to be coming out of Mr. Anderson right now?
Yeah. The airline industry, if you'll note, has not been expanding its coverage in recent years. What we need Amtrak to do is admittedly expand its coverage, work with us, so we could make Indiana a rail crossroads, just like in many respects it's a road crossroads. And you're absolutely right. It's not just linking point A and point B. It's linking a whole bunch of smaller cities and towns. What we and other organizations have found, particularly in some other states surrounding Indiana, is that when you go out and look at smaller communities, it doesn't matter whether they're Republican, Democrat, or something else, these smaller communities all get very enthused at the idea of a modern rail link, you know, to the larger metropolitan areas. And I think that's one of the benefits we'd want to bring to Indiana by expanding service. And we really would need a viable Amtrak as a partner to do this, unless something completely unforeseen happens. So, we're very concerned about these things.
One of the things I know that we have talked about sometimes off the air, but I think maybe it's worth mentioning in the program, is about how people that would like to find out more about the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance can find out more, and maybe they too might be able to get some line up some copies of the monthly newsletter to come out, so they can keep track of these issues and help pass the word along too. Give us the website address and how people can find out more if they'd like to get the newsletter.
Okay, the website address, and it harkens back to an older incarnation, it is IndianaHighSpeedRail.org.
That's easy enough to keep track of and find that way, too. And that, in turn, if you want to get a copy of All Aboard Indiana, which is the name of the newsletter, you can line that up that way, too, I imagine.
Yeah, there are copies available online. We have those out on the web as a PDF file, which is readable by most people's computers these days. If you want to send us an email, our email address is info@IndianaHighSpeedRail.org. And you could send a request to be put on the mailing list, a request for a hard copy of the newsletter, a question, a suggestion. So we're out there, definitely in the public.
Well, Steve Coxhead, thank you for spending time with us to talk about some of the latest concerns that the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance has about not only the Hoosier State and the other Amtrak lines that crisscross Indiana and come through Northwest Indiana in particular, but some of the other concerns that you have statewide about passenger rail service. And we'll be back with you again soon, I hope.
Thank you much, Chris.
You're welcome. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. In spite of the awareness, the gender pay gap still exists everywhere, and the state of Indiana, and Northwest Indiana specifically, is one of the worst offenders. The CEO of the American Association of University Women, which is based in Washington, D.C., Kim Churches, spoke recently with Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson about the problem and some solutions, and here's their conversation.
Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me. Can you tell us about the gender pay gap in Northwest Indiana?
I sure can. In fact, my mother resides in Northwest Indiana, so it's an area that I'm very, very familiar with. So basically, based on the new census data that was released last week, AUW took a gender slice to that data to really look at the nation, each state, and every congressional district. And as we look at Northwest Indiana, we find that women are earning roughly between 66 and 74% of what males are earning in full-time employment at the state as well. So this is alarming because it's actually below the national average. The national average shows that the gap is 80 cents on the dollar overall for women working full-time compared to their male counterparts working full-time in the United States.
And so it compares, it's a bad comparison because Northwest Indiana is a worst offender for unequal pay.
Yeah, it is. You're below the national average of the 80 cents on the dollar, which is concerning. And now there's some things that can be done. Indiana overall has what we consider weak state equal pay laws. Many, many states, in fact, there are 42 states this year, many times working in bipartisan efforts to put forward stronger equal pay laws because this really becomes about economic security for families. This is not just about a women's rights issue. This is a human rights and family rights issue to ensure all have a wage matched to their skills and abilities.
So what's being done in Indiana to address this pay gap? Is there legislation being crafted to protect families, to wipe this problem out?
So not enough in our view. And in fact, our members and advocates on the ground in Indiana, I know, have been advocating and lobbying their elected leaders for more. So as an example, you know, an example of strong equal pay laws would be like those in states like California and Illinois, Maryland, Massachusetts, Oregon, and Washington, and others. In the state of Indiana, there are some really easy ones that could be passed that could truly help to ensure that the Equal Pay Act, which is now 55 years old and in need of updating, had some safety nets for all full-time working employees, and whether they're hourly or salaried in the state of Indiana. So one example would be a bill to prohibit using salary history in hiring. And why is that important? Because women are traditionally paid less than their male counterparts. And if you're applying for a new job and you're using former salaries as the guide to your future salary, that may have nothing to do with what the market will bear for the job that you're applying for. And so you can have bias against you just because you were paid less in your former job, even though the going rate may be higher in the job you're applying for. So by prohibiting using salary history in hiring, that can really help to level the playing field or at least start to close that pay gap.
Because what, prospective new employers use your previous salary to bump you just barely higher? Is that what it is?
You got it. Or go to the lower end because you were making less. So say you're applying for a job that has a range of 60 to 70, but in your last job you were being paid 47. They might think they could get some savings out of you and offer you less than their low end. And that's how it just compounds and perpetuates the pay gap over time. And we're seeing in states that have passed more pay equity laws, actually that gap is starting to close. I will say pay equity laws in and of themselves are not enough to do everything because, you know, we've passed many laws in this country and we still have other issues around culture and societal needs to continuously improve. So we try to take a multi-pronged approach. We look at this of advocating for local, state, and federal equal pay laws and strengthening those laws, as we've been talking about. We want to work with employers in the nonprofit, educational sectors, and every industry, private and public in the nation, to help employers to improve their practices and their workplace cultures, working with them on ongoing training on things like pay audits to make sure that unconscious bias is not adding to the pay gap within their companies or organizations. And then last, we're aiming to train 10 million women in 5 years how to negotiate their own salaries and secure their own financial futures, because we believe that's the other part of a multi-pronged approach here, is to ensure women have the skills and tactics needed to negotiate on behalf of themselves.
Since this issue is pretty well known now, how come it hasn't been solved already, and what's standing in the way of it? The solution, yeah.
Yeah, it's a pretty sad state of affairs that I have to say that women on average, it's basically flat to last year, and we haven't made these vast improvements. Look, a lot of times women are concerned about advocating on behalf of themselves. They fear retribution or worse, or getting fired. I think that, you know, there are some implicit biases that all of us as human beings have, and sadly, even people who take an implicit bias test, we have 170,000 AEW members and advocates who are firmly behind our mission to advance gender equity, and yet some of us have implicit biases as to thinking what is a man's job versus a woman's job and what it's worth. And so we all have to be exceedingly mindful to get this fixed. Sadly, the improvements on the pay gap have only moved up by 5 cents, just a nickel, in the last two decades, and that's just not enough. So that's why we're doubling down at AUW and making a concerted effort over the next 5 years, and then we're hoping that we can close the pay gap by 2030 in our lifetime.
How can people help in your mission to close that gap?
So one is, we'll be offering online, absolutely free salary negotiation course that you can take at AEUW.org at the end of this month. We also offer in-person workshops around the nation, and we're working in partnerships with mayors and governors in red, blue, and purple states, because this is about an economic security issue. Secondly, I think, you know, people, your listeners, can certainly think about and look at their own employee handbooks. What are are their employers doing to ensure that women's voices are heard in this and are protected as they think about pay gaps? And if you're a hiring manager and you're looking at this, what are some things that you can do to improve workplace cultures and allow women to thrive in the same way that men have thrived? And then last is talking to your elected leaders, talking to your members of U.S. Congress and saying we need to pass the Paycheck Fairness Act, asking them to co-sponsor this act so that it can improve upon the Equal Pay Act. Talk to your state legislature about some of these additional bills that could be introduced, such as prohibiting using salary history or prohibiting job tracking based on sex or passing a bill on including protected classes in addition to sex in bills so that people in the workplace can be protected.
I'm thinking about organizations, companies, you know, not wanting to pay more. What are we going to do about them? Because I'm sure that there's some parties that don't want to see this addressed because they don't want to part with more profits.
So here's the amazing thing. I think we both would agree that hiring and firing and attrition is very, very expensive. And the sad thing is that women just check out when they feel undervalued, their productivity, or they simply leave the company. And hiring, firing, and attrition rates are exceedingly expensive for any enterprise, whether it's a for-profit or nonprofit or educational institution, for lack of time, resources, et cetera. Actually, study after study after study has shown that when women are paid what their male counterparts are paid on the same skills and abilities, the ROI increases on every business line. The same is true for the leadership gap. And I would say that the pay gap and the leadership gap and seeing more women in seats throughout an organization's hierarchy actually leads to stronger return on investment, a better bottom line for every business line.
And what can we do as just people out here in the workforce to try to help solve the problem of the pay gap?
One, be aware of your own implicit bias. And there is a link on Harvard University's website for the implicit bias test. All of us, it's not to say that all biases, you know, some of them are protectionism that we use as human beings, but understanding and checking your own implicit bias at the door so that you are hiring and promoting and being colleagues with all humans in your workforce and not perpetuating old stereotypes. So that's one. Two, consider taking our salary negotiation course. It's completely free, and we want to empower women with more resources, whether you're an hourly wage earner or a salaried employee, to ensure that you're being paid what your skills and abilities are worth. And we've seen it's evidence-based, and we've seen women earning 15, 20, 25% more in their salaries once they've taken the course and renegotiated their salaries.
And where can you find that course?
You bet. You can find that course on our website at salary.aauw.org.
And that's going to be available at the end of the month?
It'll be an online module at the end of the month, totally free, and then will be released in Spanish as well in the following month. But right now, we're offering in-person workshops totally free as well all over the country, and there'll be a list of those on our website available too.
What about women who, and anybody for that matter, they're getting a new job and they don't want to price themselves out of a job, so they're afraid to ask for what they deserve?
Yeah, that's exactly what we teach them in the course. So it's not just a matter of the confidence-building skills of how to negotiate. Very importantly, what we're teaching you is about your marketplace, where you are in the geography, where you are on that job title, how it compares and contrasts with other jobs with those skills and abilities, so that you can have a range that you believe is your sweet spot, and you can negotiate much more carefully on that. So we're giving you the quants as well as the qualitative work in the workshop.
Is there anything else that you want to add that maybe I haven't asked you about?
No, I would say honestly that time's up on the pay gap, and this is about math. It's not about myth. And what we have to understand is that this pay gap is systemic in every geography, in every zip code, in every industry, at every range of our socioeconomic status. But we can do something about it with this multi-pronged approach.
Well, thank you so much. We've been talking with Kimberly Churches, the CEO of the American Association of University Women.
Thank you.
And that's Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Residents of the town of Griffith will get to choose if they have signed up to be able to vote in the upcoming referendum, whether they will in turn be residents of Calumet Township or of some other township in Lake County. It's all because of what's happened in the past, and this is the second time around, I guess, for a petition drive that has made it to this point for a special election that is to be held tomorrow, Tuesday, in the town of Griffith. And with us to talk about it, we have the president of the Griffith Town Council, Rick Reifel, with us. Rick, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks, Chris.
Give a real quick overview of what's gotten us to the point that there will be a special election on Tuesday for residents of Griffith to decide whether they want to be continuing members of Calumet Township.
This entire process started many, many years ago, but it culminated with legislation that was passed in 2018. That legislation stated that if there is any municipality inside a township that has a tax rate that is over 12 times the state average, that township could then have its citizens petition for a public question asking whether or not to leave that particular township and join an adjacent one.
We talked about this in the past before, I know in past conversations, that it's mainly a concern that that residents and officials in the town of Griffith have is that they're not getting their fair share of whatever revenues that the Calumet Township government takes in that would come back to the form of services for residents in Griffith, isn't it?
That's correct, Jim. Years ago, the first numbers we had, Griffith was putting approximately $3.2 million in and getting less than $11,000 in return. After the law was passed in 2013, the number of dollars that were sent to Calumet Township reduced to about $1 million, but that was in 2016 and 2017. Climbed to $1.4 million, and it looks like 2018 is actually $2.17
million. Mm-hmm.
Still don't see any benefits coming in. The bigger issue, and I've maintained this for a long time, is the fact that the money that does go to poor relief is minimal, even in the township compared to the overall budget. They still spend more on administrative costs than they do on actual poor relief. So that is the issue that needs to be addressed within the township.
Is that an issue that not only is with the township assessor, but the township trustees staff as well, too?
Well, I would think it doesn't. The assessor is completely different than the. This would be within the trustees' office,
yeah.
I think Kim Robinson, you know, she's done a pretty good job to reduce the number. However, I think the system is just inherently broken, and I don't know what's needed to fix it. But it's unfortunate that, you know, if you're bringing in $68 million and only $3 million of it's going to the poor for poor relief, that numbers aren't that good. I mean, even United Way's got much higher numbers than that. Charities do. And I understand there's overhead, but it is concerning for the citizens that are left behind.
I know in 2016, you had a chance to go for another first petition drive, actually, I guess, to seek this referendum vote. It was halted by the Calumet Township Trustee's Office. What were the excuses or reasons that they gave then?
They had a variety. One of the big ones was the controversy whether we're using a weighted or arithmetic average. They filed in the local Lake Superior Court, then filed in the appellate court in Indiana, then filed all the way up to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court eventually just threw the case out.
Mm-hmm.
So we filed a new petition in 2018 based on current numbers, which leaves no question whether or not they're over the 12 times state average. I believe they are 17 times over, using the weighted method, which is the argument they said we should use, and I think it's almost over 30 times if you use the arithmetic mean. So it really doesn't matter now which method's used, because they're over on both sides. So that's why we filed a new petition with new signatures, just to make sure that there could be no other future lawsuits.
We're talking with Griffith Council President Rick Reifel about Calumet Township and the referendum vote that is going to happen on Tuesday. If things go well during the referendum vote, what is going to be the next step, I guess, to make for residents in Griffith, and in turn, what's going to happen about those property tax levies?
We have our financial people are preparing some documents that show what the new tax rates would be for Griffith residents if we went to either North Ross or St. John Township. We're also showing what the effects would be on anybody within that particular township. The initial reports we see, if all the levies are, or not if all the levies, if all the tax rates are remain the same,
mm-hmm.
it would have a zero effect on anybody living in North Ross or St. John Township. And then we would just take on the same tax rate that they currently have.
Mm-hmm.
That would ultimately be up to their board of trustees to determine what the actual rates would be. But you would think that with more money coming in at the same rate, that would be able to enhance their services, have a few dollars, quite a few dollars extra in revenue, and their citizens would have a level tax rate.
Now, I would imagine that you've had this opportunity here before, the referendum votes even coming up here, to consult with North Township, with St. John Township, which I guess is already including part of the town of Griffith anyway, I understand, as well as Ross Township, to find out if they're interested in taking on, I guess, the town of Griffith as well, too, haven't you?
Actually, Chris, we've stayed away from that. This referendum is strictly a vote whether or not our voters would want to secede from Calumet Township and join in the adjacent one. Don't want this vote to become about whether or not it's going to be St. John, Ross, or North.
So that'll come later. That'll be a decision made after the voters go to the polls and decide whether they are in favor or not in favor of secession.
Correct. And the plan is in early October, we present all of our residents with all the options, the financial impact, et cetera, and ask for their feedback to see which what they prefer. Because ultimately, the town council will pass a resolution approaching one, two, or all three at the same time.
Uh-huh.
But we want to do so with a well-informed citizenry, so they can, we want to hear to where they want to go to, essentially. That's what we're here for.
Now, Rick, tell us what's happening now as you get ready for the actual vote tomorrow. How are things all set up for residents in Griffith to go cast their ballots? And once those ballots are cast, when things finish up tomorrow evening, where are ballots going to be in turn tallied and the decision made?
We've been well prepared for the election. We've advertised it extensively. The polls are open from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. tomorrow. People will vote at their normal voting place. And we will be tallying the votes, the unofficial vote tally, at Griffith Town Hall at 6 p.m. And I expect to have full results no later than 6:30, probably sooner than that. After that, I believe there is an election day, hopefully celebration party at the Bridges scoreboard in Griffith. And hopefully the whole town will turn out and celebrate the victory for us.
Now, for such an event like this, where you have basically one question and a yes or no, on the ballot, so to speak, for a referendum, how are you handling it? Is it going to be like on a paper ballot, or is it going to be on the electronic machines?
It's all on the machines. Mm-hmm. There will be one question on the ballot that was stipulated in the state law that was passed. The question has to read exactly how it says in the law. It says, shall the territory of the town of Griffith be transferred from Calumet Township to an adjacent township? And there will be a box to check yes or no.
Can't get much simpler than that, I suppose. I would imagine, too, that probably for such a simple event like this, because this is so important, and this is, I guess you've put it in the story in the Times as a once-in-a-lifetime vote, an opportunity for residents of Griffith to speak up and say whether they want any more of being members of Calumet Township or not. It's their decision to make, and puts a little bit of strain on you, I guess, or you and the rest of the town council, too. You all want to see this thing go through at least and know one way or the other at the end of the day on Tuesday.
Exactly. We worked very hard to get to this point, just to be able to have a vote whether or not we want our citizens will vote to secede. There is no opportunity to revisit this. The state law specifically states that if this vote fails, it can never ever be brought up again.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I said, there's either you win or you go home. There's no do over on this one.
A little different than the typical election, like the one coming up here in November, where you have people on the ballot and a choice to be made, and there are winners and losers. I guess that's no different than in this case, but you could do something again in the next election after that. This is the time that you have to speak up and make your voice heard, I suppose, too. So I'm sure a lot of residents in Griffith have spoken up so far. I have seen, driving around occasionally in the last few days, a number of signs supporting the vote coming up tomorrow evening. And of course, there are the The big sign that's set up there in Town Park mentions, Central Park mentions too, about the fact that it is coming up. So residents, if you say you've had plenty of opportunity to be told about the special referendum vote coming up on Tuesday. So best we could say is we'll see what happens. Good luck to you and the residents of Griffith as to how this is going to turn out. And we hope to have some interesting news to put forth on Wednesday morning about this too, to be sure. Rick, thank you very much for being with us to talk about this. And the voters decide to come out and make their voices heard. This is their opportunity to do so.
Thank you, Chris. Have a great day.
Rick Reifa is the president of the Griffith Town Council. We sometimes wonder if we're making the right choices to save our money for the future, if we're staying ahead of inflation, or to make sure our money is working hard even if we aren't. Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer was on Regionally Speaking recently with some answers. Give us a clue here, first off, some of the reasons we should be really thinking it over carefully before we make an investment.
Well, I think first and foremost is just understanding what options you have before you make the investment, and more specifically, you know, what the purpose of those monies are. But once you figure out what your risk tolerance is and the time horizon matches, then it's a little bit easier to decide, hey, what type of options do I want to explore, you know, something very slow growing or, you know, safe versus something that's got more growth potential long term.
Is it something that we have to really take a look at, looking at the, almost like the calendar, or can look at it on a much broader scale?
Well, I think you can look at a much broader scale. You know, we look at kind of organizing investments over the purpose of the money. So if we have people that are, you know, 10, 15, 20, 30 years out from retirement, you can use a lot different type of vehicle than somebody says, hey, this is money that I might need next year or the year after for college, or, you know, I might need because I'm going to purchase a vehicle. So defining the purpose of the dollars, number one, is important because the most critical thing in any investment is time horizon.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you are able to figure out the time horizon, understanding how you can diversify within several different types of asset classes, not just within the market, but outside the market, things that wouldn't correlate, you know, like real estate, for example, if that was an option that you're attracted to, or, you know, some other type of instrument that would, you know, reduce the volatility of the marketplace.
So it's really important to really know what kind of time span you're looking at, which are the best options for investments that you should take advantage of. Don't get yourself into something too long-term, I suppose, if you're not exactly looking for being able to get a return for your investment pretty soon.
Exactly. I always tell people if they ask me, hey, what's my portfolio going to do next year? It's a very difficult question.
Wow.
But if you say, what's my portfolio going to do over the next 8 to 10 years, it's a little bit more predictable based on the type of investment that you have. And, you know, we simply use a bucket plan concept. It's organizing, you know, the purpose of those assets now, soon, and later. You know, now money is something that's earmarked for a plan expense, emergency money, you know, things of that nature, in which case, you know, we generally don't look at any type of volatile-type portfolio. And then your sooner or later buckets will define the purpose of those dollars. Soon meaning, hey, I'm going to need this asset in the short-term time horizon. Generally speaking, you're going to scale back a lot of the volatility. It's going to lessen your options. Liquidity is a bigger concern versus your later buckets, which would, you know, be more towards the long-term growth or legacy planning, or, you know, addressing some different things that are going to cost more in the future.
I know you referred to earlier about real estate and the importance of seeing how that fits in the options. Is that perhaps one of those options maybe it's wise to consider in one of the long-term options?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like for myself, you know, buying a home was always something I wanted when I was starting off as a, you know, as a young family man, and, you know, being able to, you know, just build that equity within something that could provide future value no matter what I decide or what I decide to use for. And then there's just other opportunities that you can look at just in the real estate end of it. You know, renting versus owning is a consideration when you're looking at, you know, your overall, you know, wealth as you're building it. And I feel like, you know, real estate can be a very effective way to build some of that net worth.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer and about some of the options for best investment. And I guess it's always important to spread out those options. Diversification is an important word to use, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, again, the significance there is just understanding if you get too specific, trying to pick, you know, a specific type of sector, for example, in the marketplace, while you can do a lot better than what the market's going to do, it could also mean that you may not perform as well as the markets, you know, and even good investments are going to have times where the fluctuation in the market are going to cause decrease in value as well as increase. And by diversifying and reallocating consistently with it, the concept of, you know, buy low, sell high holds true with that reallocation. And you're constantly not trying to pick the best horse, but, you know, trying to get consistency in your portfolio over the time horizon.
And we haven't even talked about the tax man, I guess, in these cases, but it's very important as you're getting your organization for your investments together, picking the right investments, putting them in the right place, whether it's short-term, medium, or long-term investments. But I guess the implications of what the IRS can do is very important too, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, I always tell people with the you know, my wife doesn't care what I make. It's what gets deposited in the checking account. So if you can reduce tax implications and minimize the cost, so to speak, of those of the performance, then generally you have to take a lot less risk. There's usually a lot less volatility then. You know, there's a lot more stability and predictability in the portfolios just by simply reducing the cost of that investment or the exposure to tax. Not only now, but in the future.
So we're talking about options that they're not only good just to look at, even if you're not close enough to retirement yet, but something to look at if you want to do some expansion of your income in the near future, I suppose, to point.
Oh, absolutely. You hit it right in the head, depending, again, once you kind of understand, you know, where that money's going to fall within your planning process and what the purpose of it is, you know, simple things like utilizing a Roth, even for college, could help minimize the cost of tax exposure on that asset and give you flexibility for in the future, looking at tax-free, tax-deferred, tax-efficient type portfolios can help mitigate the rest near tax risk near term. And then, you know, just the types of sources of income you're going to have in retirement will directly determine, you know, taxation on things like your Social Security and, you know, how much marginal tax rate you hit.
That's Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. Time once again for another edition of Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Scott McDonald, the Executive Director at Memorial Opera House in Valparaiso. Welcome back, Scott.
Thank you.
So, now how long have you been working at Memorial Opera House?
Let's see. I have been the Executive Director there for 2 years now, but I've been employed there for five, mm-hmm. and I started as a volunteer in 2006. Mm-hmm. So,
and you climbed your way up to a paid position.
I sure did.
That's nice.
Lucked out. It worked out that the box office manager position opened up in 2012, and I joined the staff and then became artistic director and now executive director. Mm-hmm. So it's been a really, really great journey.
So the Opera House is affiliated with the county government in Porter County.
Correct. Porter County government owns the building.
And do they also provide you with funding?
They provide me with how much I'm allowed to spend. But
I see. So
otherwise,
they give you a budget.
Yes, they do give us a budget, but we are pretty much self-sufficient in mm-hmm. that if we don't make it, we don't spend it.
And you write grants and you
yes.
try to raise money.
Mm-hmm.
Out
yep. We have a nonprofit arm, Memorial Opera House Foundation.
Oh, good.
They take care of all the grants through IAC, through mm-hmm. Porter County Community Foundation. Of course, sponsorships and donations also make a very, very large part of what we do possible.
And you're celebrating your 125th anniversary.
We certainly are. The building was built in 1893 as a Civil War memorial to mm-hmm. the men who laid down their lives in the Civil War from Porter County.
Mm-hmm.
It was rededicated in 2012 as a memorial to veterans of all wars.
Hmm.
And we've had some really great names come through the building. Beulah Bondi, who played Jimmy Stewart's mother in the Mr. Smith movies mm-hmm. and in It's a Wonderful Life.
Mm-hmm.
She got her start on our stage in 1907. The Marx Brothers performed there in 1919. President Roosevelt, when he was stumping for vice president, he delivered one of his speeches there. William Jennings Bryan delivered a speech there. Mm-hmm. Of course, John Philip Sousa. It was allegedly one of his favorite rooms to play. So,
really?
Yeah. There's a lot of history tied
and
up in our building.
And what brought John Philip Sousa to Valparaiso?
You know, I think it was one of those tours through the Midwest as he was doing different world fairs and state fairs and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And we were one of the stops along the railroad line, and he found us and loved
cool.
the place and came back several times. So.
And how many does it seat?
350.
It's a nice size.
It's a great venue.
Yeah.
It's not huge. It's not like super intimate, but it's just it's reminiscent of like a Broadway house mm-hmm. in that it's kind of small and narrow, but mm-hmm. there's not a bad seat in the house.
And so, you're celebrating the 125th anniversary
we are.
With the production of Sweeney Todd.
We certainly are. We did the show last in 2001, and this season we've kind of done things that we've done in the past, some new things just to introduce our audience and develop our audience a little bit more, and it's been really, really wonderful. Sweeney Todd has been a blast to work on, though. We are in our fourth week of rehearsal right now. It opens at the end of the month, September 28th through October 14th, the show runs. And there's 20 people in the cast, and it moves like a freight train. I mean, you're familiar with the show.
Oh,
and
for such a gruesome story.
it's a lot of fun.
It's so popular.
It's a lot of fun. And there have been several Broadway revivals of the show recently. There was a really wonderful off-Broadway revival. Of course, the movie.
The one at Barrow Street.
Yes.
The Village.
Yes.
And it's run forever.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know.
And it's just, it's exciting.
I'm on their email list.
Yeah. So I actually got to see the production and it was wonderful.
Uh-huh.
And, but it's really exciting to see how well received the show has been. And it's also turning our demographic a little bit. We're starting to see a younger demographic come in because of some of the newer productions that we're doing.
Well, that's good because Valpo has a huge population of younger families.
It really, really does. And with the university right there, the university did Sweeney Todd, I want to say 2 or 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also lent to some of the popularity because the students want to come see what we're doing with it.
Well,
so
if for bloody massacre murder,
right.
It has catchy tunes.
It certainly does. You
really
know, Sondheim
clever.
Did a really nice job writing some of the great things about, you know, how to murder people and
exactly.
bake them. So,
well, and I always associate it with the original cast. And,
yeah, of course.
And Angela Lansbury, who, you know, always makes you feel good because of Murder, She Wrote, another
right.
murder thing.
Right. And, you know, of course, Mrs. Potts and Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah. Right, right. Well, this sounds like a good way to celebrate.
Yeah.
And tell us the dates one more time.
Sure. We run September 28th through October 14th.
Okay. And you can get tickets online.
Yep. MemorialOperaHouse.com, or you can contact our box office at 219-548-9137.
Okay.
Stacey will be happy to take care of that for
you.
We'll
have a fun celebration.
Thank you.
Thank you, Scott, for being here.
It's always
a
pleasure.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
That's John Kane with Scott McDonald, who's executive director of the Memorial Opera House. You can hear this conversation again later today online at our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, where all of the Eye on the Arts conversations are posted. And hope you'll join us again next Monday at this time for Eye on the Arts here on Regionally Speaking. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.